very early work, and that, of course, lots of hard work from Joachim, Marin, Michael, Rademacher, Paul Penzack, etc. And the first of the topic three, reconstruction, image restoration, and also how to deal with heterogeneous populations, will be more course-based, and I hope it won't be too simple for you, and then we'll have a look at what actually happens. So 3D reconstruction, I like to use my favorite particle, Jan. He's a three-dimensional object. He's going to be frozen in this thin layer in a shallow swimming pool, and then put inside this machine where we'll shoot electrons through Jan, and they will go actually through them. So we have true transmission images, which are a bit like the X-ray pictures you would take of Jan in the hospital, because those are rather ugly. I'll show black and white images to kind of have it two-dimensional, but you should keep in mind that the kind of views you get from your molecules is much more like that X-ray picture than like the black and white picture of Jan. So that's our first problem, that we collect these data in two dimensions on a two-dimensional detector, and what we're really interested in is the three-dimensional structure of Jan. So then there's other inconveniences that we need to defocus to get some contrast. The microscope isn't perfect either. And then what was perhaps a perfect image, projection image of Jan, kind of gets convolved with this point spread function, and the Fourier transform of that we call the CTF. And on top of that, Jan is very sensitive to the electrons we put on him in, so we can only use very few before we burn him away, and that then leads to high amounts of noise in the images. So we have hopefully many thousands or hundreds of thousands, and some people even like millions of these individual particles, and we now want to reconstruct these into 3D. Because Jan was tumbling around in that swimming pool in many different orientations, we do have views of Jan in many different directions, and now the task at hand is to combine all these in a 3D reconstruction. So many of the software packages out there use projection matching to do that, so I thought I'd just very quickly run through it. If we have some kind of initial three-dimensional guess of how Jan would look like, and I'll come back to how we do that, we can make computer-generated projections of that initial 3D model, and we can compare each of these reference projections with each of the experimental projections of Jan, and we can invent some similarity index, cross-correlation, for example, and we assign this view as a top view slightly from the side. And that we can do for the many thousands of different images that we have, and then everybody has a relative orientation to the 3D object. We can then do this reconstruction. And how does that work? For that, I think, in my mind, it's easiest to explain with this Fourier slice theorem, which says that if we have a three-dimensional object in real space, then we can calculate in the computer a three-dimensional Fourier transform of that object. And I assume you're familiar with that. In the microscope, what happens, there will be a two-dimensional projection along the red arrows through the 3D object, and of a two-dimensional image, we can calculate a two-dimensional Fourier transform, of course. And then the theorem says, the projection slice theorem says, that this 2D transform is a central slice through the 3D transform, and the direction of that slice is perpendicular to the directions that the electrons went through the 3D object in the beginning. So that gives us a nice framework to do that 3D reconstruction, because we have all these images of Jan, we can calculate the Fourier transform of each of them, and because we now know the direction, all these relative directions, which you've just done with this projection matching, you can put all these 2D slices back into the 3D transform, fill it all up, and do the inverse transform to get the new three-dimensional reconstruction. Now that one will look a bit like this conceptually. It's a mixture of the initial orange puppet that we started from and the actual true signal of Jan. And the reason for that is that the relative orientations we've assigned are all slightly wrong. And that is because they're not wrong in some kind of innocent random manner, but they're wrong in a systematic manner that actually reproduces the model that we used to assign those orientations in the comparisons in the actual projection matching. But the reconstruction is made from images of Jan only. There's no projections of Orange Puppet going in the reconstruction. So hopefully there's also some signal of Jan in there. And this the reconstruction, albeit a mixture, is better than the one we started from. So that means we can now do an iterative process. We can do again reconstructions of this object in all the different directions and repeat the angular assignments and do a new reconstruction. So everybody moves around a little bit. These kind of nasty non-random errors get smaller. And hopefully the new reconstruction, the influence of the Orange Puppet decreases. And then hopefully we can do this all the way to a convergence, where then hopefully we have the true reconstruction of Jan. So that's why projection matching, one of the reasons why projection matching is typically iterative. So image restoration has then to do with this CTF mostly. So we have this image and it's convolved with the function and we can correct for it. The function itself looks like a sine wave. If you take the Fourier transform of the point spread function, you get the CTF, and that has a sine wave. And the further out from focus you are, the faster the sine wave oscillates, and also the closer to zero the first peak comes in. Now there's many different ways to correct for these effects, and perhaps the probably the space most convenient to do so is the Fourier space, because I told you it's in real space it's a convolution with a point spread function, which is computationally a bit complicated, but in Fourier space it becomes a mere multiplication with a real space value, and that's much easier to do. So then perhaps the easiest way to kind of correct for these things, the most nasty thing is that the sine wave can both be positive and negative. That means that signal that was white at certain spatial frequencies can actually become black. So if you would ignore all this, then you would be averaging over white and black signals that could be opposite, and then they would all cancel out. So if you do not correct for the CTF, you will never get to higher spatial frequencies. So one of the simplest way to correct for this is just to make all the frequencies that were where the CTF was negative, you just put it an absolute value and make them positive. And that in itself is not, it's quite effective already, although it's possibly not the best way to do it. And I think you can then show mathematically that the optimal way how you can get the most signal out of your average or your reconstruction is to do this Wiener filter. And in the Wiener filter, you multiply each of the images with the CTF and you put them all back into that three-dimensional transform. And then you also keep a term which is the sum of all the CTF squared values, and you that also gets back. Put back in the 3D transform, and then you divide the two element-wise by each other. And by doing so, you kind of can see how this, you multiply by CTF and you divide by CTF squared. So overall, you're kind of dividing by 1 over, you're multiplying by 1 over CTF, so you divide by the CTF, which is kind of what you want to do. But by doing it this way, you avoid actual dividing by zeros, which would be a problem if you just divide the straightforward image by the CTF. So I think almost all packages now use Wiener filters for doing high resolution reconstructions. Good. Now, how to deal with heterogeneous populations, and Nico will speak about classification as well, but in the example of Jan, we now have a Jan in complex with his favorite cofactor at the time, and you want to separate the two different conformations. Now, in the early days, we would do that using supervised classification approaches. You say, oh, I probably know that Jan will have something in his hand because he's a puppet, and I'd make two different starting models to do this projection matching, and then you do an iterative refinement where you not only compare every experimental particle with the projection of one reference, but of both of them, and you just decide which one is the best, and that way you hope that you can separate the data. And that's then called multi-reference refinement, which hopefully leads to reconstructions of the two states. So, and I'll come back to that. So then what are the hot topics in processing? Now, I sat down, and these are some of the things I thought of, and perhaps I'm missing some. We can do that in the discussion. I think beam-induced motion correction, robust initial model generation, 3D classification, computational cost, automation, and ever higher resolution are things that I thought were quite hot topic in image processing then. And then what are the major mathematical approaches to this and the available software, and what are the success stories and failures? I thought I'd just run through the list with you, and then we can have a discussion about it. So beam-induced motion, I understand from John that he did discuss this already yesterday. So I think it's still a challenge, and we're still losing information there that we could retrieve better. So I think it's something to keep an eye on. I'll come back to that as well. Robust initial model generation, that is because that's a problem, because I told you, you start from this orange puppet of Jan to do this projection matching algorithm. Now, the projection matching algorithm, at every step, it's guaranteed to make the model better. So the signal of Jan will be stronger and the orange puppet signal will decrease, but it's not guaranteed that you will actually find the true reconstruction of Jan. And that is because it is a local optimizer. So you depending on where your initial model lies in the solution space, you might not be able to get to the correct reconstruction. And that could be a big problem, because then you might actually publish a structure that is not the correct one, and you might do interpretations that are hence also incorrect. So bad model in, bad model out. Now, I think nowadays, now that we have such high resolution reconstructions, it's much less of a problem than it used to be, because when we were all doing blob reconstructions, it's very hard to tell a correct blob from an incorrect blob, especially if you really believe in the incorrect blob. It can be a problem. Now, many of the incorrect structures kind of remain at the blob level, and then once you found the correct one, it dives into the real minimum, and you see all the secondary structure elements and the side chains. You kind of know you're on the right track. So it's less of a problem than it used to be. And I think here the exciting new things have been the introduction of stochastic methods to actually, and that means that in this expectation maximization, this projection matching algorithm, you introduce some sort of randomness, and that kind of gives the algorithm the possibility to escape from local minima. And if you're trained in crystallography, for example, simulated annealing in that field is very popular, where you heat up things and you put in kinetic energy on the atoms in refinement, for example. And I think in our field, probably Hans Almlund was the first to really promote this in his stochastic hill climbing in the SIMPLE program. And I think Powell implemented similar thing in Sparks as well. And then I think now 2 years ago, so Marcus Brubaker in Toronto introduced CryoSpark, where they use stochastic gradient descent, which he showed was very robust in being able to get correct initial models. And I made a similar implementation later on in Relan as well. So with these kind of stochastic models, it's now, there's not many projects, I would say, that still resist getting a good initial model out. So, but it also, it does relate to failures and getting stuck with the wrong initial model. And one example, for example, is then this polymerase, the 2-PIC pre-initiation complex, where even though you used some of these stochastic methods, you might still end up with the wrong model. But again, this is quite old. It's still from the blob era, and I think nowadays those errors can be prevented. Okay. Now, I think 3D classification or dealing with structural heterogeneity remains a problem and a hot topic, and Nico will have a whole talk about it. I mentioned supervised classification just before, where you say, oh, you kind of know Jan will have something in his hands. That's only true perhaps for ribosomes or so, where this was developed for, because you kind of know a lot, or that's just too strong a statement, but systems where you know a lot about these methods are useful. In general, we don't know, and that's one of the reasons why we do the structural analysis, is also to find out about the heterogeneity that happens. So, and I think that's where then maximum likelihood methods played an important role, where you replace this similarity measure where you and how what you do with it. So just this cross-correlation coefficient, where we said, oh, this was a top view slightly from the side, could have been based on a very, very noisy cross-correlation target, because there's so much noise in the experimental image that it might, just because of noise, might be wrong, might be correct, but these discrete decisions become very stochastic. So the alternative way of doing this is then these maximum likelihood methods. And at the core of that is marginalization over the angles. And what that means is that rather than looking for the maximum cross-correlation, we calculate a quite equivalent probability of each orientation being correct. And if the probabilities are non-zero in any direction, we will put all those directions back into the reconstruction, but with the corresponding probability weights. So rather choosing for this example, choosing a side view slightly from the left and over slightly from the right because the probability is slightly higher, we say, oh, the probability is higher, yes, this will go in with a bigger weight than this one, but this one will also go in because I really can't tell which one is the correct one based on the levels of noise in the data. And then we do this weighted average angular assignments, if you like. So we do reconstructions where each particle goes in with many different orientations, all weighted. And the intuitive explanation that why that might be better is that it's then better not to, if stochastically by choosing just the highest value of the probability or the cross-correlation coefficient, which might be quite noisy, that can be right, but it might also be just wrong because of the noise in the data. And it's better to not make those wrong decisions. It's better to say, okay, I don't know, I'll hold back and I'll put it in more or less with equal weights, and then perhaps later on in the refinement things will be clearer. That has been shown to have better convergence behavior. Okay, so that then allowed for example for ribosomes, and I think many of the 3D classification algorithms out there still work in similar ways. So it allowed unsupervised classification, where you initially divide the data just in a often user-defined number of subsets, and you do initial reconstruction. Then these in this case, we took four random subsets of a ribosome data set, and these are only different from each other based on random subsets, so the differences have no meaning. But you can do these four together in a competitive multi-reference refinement, just as before, but now marginalizing over all the orientations and also over the classes. So for every particle, you calculate probabilities for contributing to each of these four classes in all of the possible orientations, and they go in with weighted averages over there. And then you can show that these data sets then can be separated without knowing beforehand what the structural variability is into more homogeneous subsets. Okay, so in general, maximum likelihood approaches were first described by Fred Sigworth in this field in a 1998 JSB paper for a 2D alignment, not a classification problem, in MATLAB. And they were then extended. I did that in XMAT while I was in Spain for 2 and 3D classification. And then Nico also made a ML-based classification scheme in FreeAlign in 2013. Yes, and at the Gordon conference, I was very happy to learn that also Powell this year has made a maximum likelihood classification option in Sparks as well. I ended up hugging him, which was the best part of my Gordon conference. Okay, so then regularized likelihood approach is kind of an addition to the maximum likelihood, where we describe the data model in Fourier space, which allows us to deal with the CTF correction very easily and also with non-white noise. It again marginalizes over all these orientations and classes, just like the real space approach. But there's a new term, and that's a regularizing term, which penalizes high spatial frequency components if the data does not provide evidence for it. So, and that into, if you do the math on that, you actually boil down to a derivation of the 3D Wiener filter, and that then gives you the optimal reconstruction for the given data sets that you have. And I think the essence of that is that you basically, it acts as a low-pass filter, in an anisotropic three-dimensional low-pass filter with the optimal shape and extent that gets learned from the data itself. So the user no longer has to play with low-pass filters on the images or on the reconstructions to kind of keep overfitting at bay and yet keep the refinement going as well as you can. That kind of expert-driven process perhaps in some of the older packages is replaced by actual the algorithm learning itself this optimal filter from the data. And that makes it relatively easy to do very high quality refinements because you take that user expertise away. It also, of course, leads to objectivity. So that's the main basis in RelyOn, which was released in 2012. And also CryoSpark from Marcus uses the exact same optimization target, I think. Good. So another hot topic since 2014 is computational costs, and I think this has been very good. At 2014, this was a big problem, and now it's much less of a problem. Mike will also speak about cloud computing later on after lunch, I think. And a lot has been done to reduce computational costs in the past few years. And I thought the approach that Marcus again introduced for CryoSpark, which is branch and bound, which is basically a formal way of learning how to start to do local searches. Because one way we all packages speed up their calculations is that you no longer, at some point on in the refinement, in this iterative process of finding better orientations, you no longer look at all of them, but you kind of take ever finer steps. And at some point you just say, okay, I'll just look around the best position from the previous iteration because I kind of know it's not a side view or a front view. I kind of know it's a top view, but I just want to get a very accurate idea of where the top view exactly is with a very fine step. So we do these local searches, and all packages, RelyOn included, have kind of ad hoc approaches to that with certain parameters that either I choose or the user chooses. Whereas Marcus was the first to kind of formalize that in CryoSpark. That's one of the reasons why CryoSpark is fast, I think. The other reason is, of course, GPU implementations. And this, I guess, started with the motion core algorithms that perhaps John described yesterday, but also Kai Zong at the LMB wrote his GCTF program, and then Eman has done GPU acceleration of tomogram averaging for many years already, I think, and now also RelyOn and CryoSpark have these GPU implementations. In RelyOn's case, I don't know how to program GPU, so that's a group of Eric Lindahl in Sweden. And these implementations, at least for RelyOn and also CryoSpark, have made it possible. You can now do these refinements just on a kind of desktop machine that your nephew would be very happy to play games with, and which you could just pick up at the store down the street for a few $1,000s or so, rather than using a very big computer cluster, which would be very expensive to buy and to maintain and administer. I think there's also still space for faster CPU implementations, and I think Nico with FreeAlign is pushing that to some extent more than the GPUs. CTF Find 4 has become, I don't know, at least an order of magnitude faster compared to 3, I think, if not more. So we can, the difference between GCTF and CTF Find 4 isn't that big anymore, I think. And the people in Sweden who I collaborate with have now been working also with engineers from Intel, and you can use vectorized computations on the CPU as well as kind of these many core CPU developments go on. And they now have a version of RelyOn that runs about 10 times faster on the CPU, just normal Intel Xeon cores than RelyOn 2 is running. So I think also it's not only GPU, the CPU side is also improving. And I think at some point these will again merge together, but we'll see that that comes. So now you can do desktop-based structured determination, and you can actually do that probably faster than actually acquiring the data. So if you can process faster than you can acquire, then that means you can do streaming, and streaming being kind of on-the-fly data processing. As the images come in, you start processing them. And then perhaps when your session finishes a few hours later, you have your structure there. That would be one way to go forward. So that, I think, is a hot topic in itself. Scipion, the package in Madrid, does that. I think, does Appian do streaming? It's here, but yeah. Henning Stahlberg wrote a new package called Focus, and I'm sure Simple does it, Relan does it. I'm sure I'm forgetting many in this list here. And I think that's something that will increase over the years, because it's really useful when you start collecting your data and you put on Legion or SiriVM or EPU to actually do that automated manner. You have some time. You can start looking at the 2D classes that come off and see, actually, the data that I am now collecting, is it any good, or should I go to thicker eyes or thinner eyes, or should I put in a whole new grid altogether? So I think by doing streaming and automation, not only makes our life easier, we can also make better use of our microscopy time. Good. And I think ultimately we want to do that all the way up to 3D refinement and see, oh, this data only goes to 3 angstroms, I better put in a better grid or so. Okay. Last hot topic is, how are we doing for time? Okay. Last hot topic is ever higher resolution. And I think SRIRAM has been leading the way here. Subramanian at the NIH with 2.2 angstrom structure of beta-galactosidase, 1.8, I think, of glutamate dehydrogenase. He presented some pictures in Stockholm in May last year, where we were at a conference where you could see individual atoms appearing in beta-gal. So I think that's very exciting stuff coming up. I think that data set, those data sets were collected, many of them were collected manually, and there was a lot of microscopy time going in it. So how to get to ever higher resolution? We all would like to do 2 angstrom structures. Model building gets so much easier at 2 angstroms than at 4. But we can't afford to put a grid in for a month in the microscope. So we have to kind of optimize things further there. And perhaps already with the kind of images that we get nowadays, if we do certain things like evil sphere, beam tilt, local CTF, anisotropic or not magnification differences, can we squeeze out much more of the data that we already have? I think there is still quite a bit of gain to be made. Beam-induced motion should have been there as well. Good. What are the success stories and the failures?
So can I ask a question?
Yes.
And blah, blah, blah. I don't think SRIRAM did any of that for his 1.8 and 2 angstrom structures. So.
No. So in Stockholm, he didn't say much, but I did ask him a question. And I think per particle CTF and beam-induced motion were 2 things he mentioned that were important for, because he said in Stockholm, he now took the 2.2 angstrom map and made it into something much better. We didn't get a real number out, but. So that's just the point. I think, and we've been thinking along similar lines in my group, there's still things we can do much better there. In Relion, when we calculate these B factor plots in the polishing per movie frame, the first few frames have always very high B factors. So the high spatial frequency components are completely downweighted, whereas that's where all the high spatial frequency is, because the radiation damage has not yet set in. And the reason for that is that initial motion. So the potential gain you can get by putting that up to horizontal, which to some extent Chris Russo's grids already do, the gold grids kind of puts it up, but should just go down. So by dealing with that motion better, the potential gains are very good. And I think there's still room either in things like Motion Core 2 kind of tries to do this, but a per particle basis, like in polishing, in Relion, in principle, should be able to do better, I think. Anyway, we're trying to work on that, and I understand SRIRAM has as well. So there are things we can do better, I think. Good. Success stories, well, we all do these beautiful atomic resolution structures. Now if people go to the scope and they go, oh, I only got 4 angstroms, whereas when we were in 2014, people would have been probably still over the moon to do 4 angstroms. So that's reflected in this graph from this review that Ardan wrote. then that of course was a big success story, and my congratulations to all three of them for winning a Nobel Prize, and that's also a success for the whole field and for all of us, of course. And it comes back to, of course, Joachim, all his early contributions to image processing as well for this session. Okay, what are the failures? And this has kind of remained the same as what I showed in 2014, because at least in our hands, it hasn't really become that much better, I think. You never hear of them. And most often, it's just the sample and the grid preparation that makes image processing a complete failure. And then it's I develop the method. It's for me, I just sit in my office and I program. I never have to go in a cold room. For me, it's very easy to say, I think you should go back to the bench and do a new protein prep. So I have to be a bit careful, but that is very often the case. And then when people do that and they come back with a better sample that stays together, or it doesn't fall apart when you make the ice too thin, or all kind of things that can go wrong, then suddenly there is no issue with image processing anymore. So you can spend a lot of time on image processing on bad data sets, but sometimes it's, if you then just make the sample better, again, I know that's much harder than I make it sound, but then the image processing goes just a lot easier. So anyway, and that in our hands hasn't really changed. That's where people still spend most of their time now. So I think in the past you could do a PhD processing a data set and calculating a structure perhaps, whereas now the actual processing, once the data is good, the processing just takes a few weeks, and then the model building might still take a while, and the interpretation and so on, but the actual 3D reconstruction is not so much labor intensive anymore. It's making those good samples and making the grids where, and that's, I guess, it's all success for the technique. So we still don't like negative stain and cross-linking, but it can be useful in some cases. Good. What are the greatest challenges right now, and how are we approaching these? This I've kind of already said also, thanks to Bridget's question. So ever higher resolutions, I think we can do better. Beam induced motion correction is one of the things, but the others in certain data sets might also help. I think Marcus, in his talk, will speak about precise CTF correction. How precise can we actually measure defocus? Because as we go to very high spatial frequencies, the sine wave starts oscillating ever faster. And if we make very small errors in the actual defocus that we think that every particle has, then at some point they will be completely out of phase, and we will be doing nothing constructive to the reconstruction anymore. So Marcus will discuss part of that. So smaller complexes is still a challenge, of course, and face plates are one possible approach, but I think that was discussed by Rado yesterday. And then I think, and that again seems the same as in 2014, that structural heterogeneity remains, in image processing, remains one of the major challenges there. Massive structural heterogeneity, Nico will speak about, and continuous flexibility, where it's not the matter that Jan has something in his hand or he hasn't, which is a discrete heterogeneity. It's a matter of Jan waving his arm about. And how many classes would you need? If you treat that with classification, you'd have to make snapshots along the whole path. So there must be a cleverer way to do this. So this is a slide that Nico sent me last night. He will speak about this kind of massive classification, what would be the problems of lysing a cell and looking at it directly. I look forward to that. I had this example as what we currently do with not so massive classification. We kind of just do divide and conquer. So we do hierarchical classification schemes, and we just try to zoom in on little parts that we're interested in. That works quite well. And then I think also quite interesting is this approach by Abbas Urmas, who does manifold embedding, which I won't go into the details, but it's aimed at dealing with the problem of continuous heterogeneity as well. And they showed this for ribosome and later for the ryonidine receptor as well. Now, in RELION, but also Yuha Huiskoon in Oxford and Hongwei Wang in China, also both in RELION, but kind of we all independently came up with this idea of doing partial signal subtraction to actually drive image classification and refinement. So we can think of a certain object as being made up of two parts, and one might move and the other one might not. Then we can the experimental images that we have are the projection of the entire machine, where these two parts could partially overlap in projection or not. So if you have a reconstruction of the part that kind of doesn't move, you could subtract that from the experimental image, such that you, in the perfect case, have an experimental image where you only have one part, and you can then do refinement on that. Yes, Yifan.
That you have this, now this is more and more rely on this focus classification and a refinement, and then get into a very small area that is part of the density that which you can build a model. Very. And one question, actually, we also start doing this, but also had the issue that by the end of the day, how do you, and this way of doing this model validation and all this sort of thing became also increasingly difficult, that or you have to do each small portion, or you have to mask out this map, and then for like one segment by segment.
Yes.
And then how is that the mask influence all these things? It's something that is straightforward or
not straightforward. I will come back to it in a second, okay? Because I have some notes on that. So the idea being, partially subtract the signal from the experimental images and then focus either your classification or your refinement on the one part. And that has worked really well in many cases. And I just show one example by Kelly Nguyen in Kiyoshi Nagai's lab on the spliceosome trisnurb, which the spliceosome is notoriously floppy with a head and a foot and an arm and I don't know what. And so a consensus reconstruction overall went to 3.7, but the head here and the I don't know all the names, the arm here, they're completely washed out because these things flop around. So you can do these mask refinements where you put mask around the head or the arm or the body and try to subtract the components, the other components from the particle images, and then try and refine each of them separately. And then this head, for example, which was not very good in the consensus map, you can still get a kind of buildable 4.2 angstrom map out of it. And you can also do classifications, etc. So this becomes where now most of the time that we spend on image processing goes in kind of figuring out on how to deal with all this. So in Relion, and I'll come to your question now, Yifan, one way to kind of automate that is, and we introduced this already in 2014 as a supplement to one of these spliceosome papers, was how about if we take the three-dimensional model and the reconstruction that we have, and we see, oh, there's a head which is floppy and an arm that's floppy and a foot that's floppy, and then the body kind of stays constant. How about we divide up that map into four different regions, and we now make masks around them, which represents the individually. The idea is that you will assume that the entire structure is made up of a given number of rigid body moving subdomains. So you use masks to define these, and these masks can overlap. And what you then do, what you would normally do in Relion, would then, okay, that's fine. I have my consensus refinement, I have the head mask, and now I subtract the body and the tail and the arm, and I will do a focus refinement on the head, and that will get better. That's what Kelly did in the slide I just showed you. The difference now is in multi-body refinements, we will, at every iteration, it's implemented as a continuation of a 3D refinement run in Relion, which would be that initial consensus run. And in every iteration, we will do, if there's three different bodies, a head, a foot, and a body, we will focus refinement on the head. We will keep the best orientation of the head for every particle. And then we do a focused refinement on the body, where we subtract the best orientation from the body and the best orientation from the tail. And then we will also do the focus refinement of the tail, where we now have better estimates for the orientations of both the head and the body, and then we do it again. So we again iterate this through, doing better subtractions at every point, which is something we usually only did once, and thereby we get automatically in one, so user convenience again improves with this, you get these better reconstructed densities for the individual bodies. And that's automated. And one example we tried it on first is this malaria parasite ribosome, which Wilson Wong did when he visited our lab. And in the original paper, we signal subtraction didn't exist yet in Reliant, so we just did masked large subunit and small subunit, and then you could get certain resolution. But the head of the ribosome was still quite fuzzy. So in the consensus refinement, if you do the entire thing on its own, you can see this is part of the large subunit, this part of the small subunit, this is the head. The head is not very good. Now we divided this reconstruction into three independent bodies, and you then get out three maps, and this is the body map of the large subunit, this is the small subunit, and this is a separate head, so the small subunit doesn't have the head. And to come back to your question, now the density improves for all three domains, and the improvement is most drastic for the most floppy domain, of course. The head actually becomes buildable here, whereas it was completely fuzzy there. But you no longer have this one big structure. That does not exist. It doesn't exist in your data. And you've actually assumed each of these body move independently, which at the biological level of side chains flipping around is probably not even true. But it helps you getting better density for parts of the model. So what Reliant will write out to kind of prevent this problem is just three separate maps. Now the biologist may want to merge them all together and make one model. That's up to the biologist, and it's a discussion we as a field could have. What we did for the spliceosome was build a model in these separately refined maps, and as a rigid body put that model into the consensus map. So it's a low resolution, but at the interfaces of the bodies, this will hurt. And we'll need to have a discussion on what to do with that. Okay, so the density for the head became a lot better. So this is the one in the consensus. And we actually, with Wilson, when he did the structure, we stopped modeling a chain there and there because there was just, even with low pass filtering and less sharpening, there was nothing there. But now in the multi-body refinement map, you can actually see quite beautifully see how those two should have been connected. So that leads to better density. That's only one part of the multi-body refinement. The other part is that we now have the relative orientations of the three bodies for the entire data set. So what you can do a PCA analysis on the actual relative orientations to get an idea of what the main motions in the ribosome are. And this is a movie of one of the major, one of the principal components, which shows you how the small subunit and the head actually, to some extent, move together with each other. There's other components where they move in orthogonal directions, but this is one of the bigger ones. So you get not only better density for the individual part, but I think one of the interesting, appealing things is you can make these kind of movies and see what kind of heterogeneity is actually causing the blurring out.
So to make these decisions on what is, you know, body, tail, arm, or whatever,
yes,
or does Reliant make
that's
those decisions?
The user currently provides masks because that's quite an intelligent decision for, you could, if you'd have a lot of computation power, you could kind of put a, because the masks can actually overlap, the program will deal correctly with that. So you could kind of run a moving window, as long as in each sphere mask, you'd have enough mass to do the alignment, because that's the main limitation here. If in one body there's not enough mass to do a refinement, then the whole thing will break down.
How much of this improvement could you get from 3D classification followed by multi-reference refinement?
Probably
separate the conformations and then...
Yeah, so for this map from the head of the ribosome, probably if I would have focused my refinement on the head and just done that manually,
no,
it
I
would
mean
have also
separating
come
separating the conformation. I guess the problem with what I'm suggesting is you start to divide your data. But if you were
yes.
to separate... Okay.
Yes, this is no division of data. This is just an analysis of... And also, this is just the rigid body density. So there is no information other than what the actual movie is kind of saying, or it flips this way. That's the information in the movie. There is no... the structural, it's just multi-body, so it's rigid body movements only. Okay, so we also did this for a spliceosome. This is a B complex. And these are the two biggest motions that happen there. And the top part here gets completely washed out in the consensus structure. But you can go all the way to, I don't know, the exact number, 4-point-something angstrom resolution with multi-body refinement, so you can actually build it. But you can also get these motions. So this can move independent of this or together with this part. This was a 4-body refinement. No, 3-body as well. We're doing the 4-body now. OK, so do we need completely new algorithms or just incremental improvements? Yes, please. New is always good. And I think it's very interesting that many, many outsiders are now flocking into our field as well. And perhaps a Nobel Prize might even interest more. And there's all kind of interesting mathematicians, computational science. I think Marcus is one good example. So, and Steve's talk will also contain things about deep learning, which is a whole thing the field hasn't explored that much, I think. And it will be interesting to hear more about that. Good, mistakes to avoid. This is one of the mistakes I had in my slide in 2014, where I spoke about monocultures, about not being much competition in microscopes and in detectors perhaps a bit more, and then in software. And the idea was that you don't want only one solution for your problems, because then you become a monoculture and you become very, very sensitive to local minima, I guess. So, and then in Arden's paper, there was this plot. So, this is going the wrong way. But I think now, with new software from Marcus, but also the team with Stefan Rauser teaming up with Powell, doing a much more user-friendly interface to Sparks, and new improvements by Nico as well, I think the orange line will probably come down, and that's probably a good thing, and we can all, because it's the competition that keeps us all on our hind feet. I mean, it wasn't until Marcus did SGD that I should probably do that as well, and then that kind of keeps us all going forward. So that's a good thing. Good. That leads me to one of my last points: building on each other's work. Okay. So RelyOn actually copied large swaths of code from XMAP, where that's my history because I was in Madrid before. My boss, Jose Maria Carazo, was with Joachim Frank before. So XMAP actually is built quite strongly on Spider. Eman and Sparks are, of course, a very good example of sharing code and building on each other's strengths. Cryospark, there is at the top here, there is open source, okay? That's there. Now then, Cryospark is kind of in the middle because now we'll have closed source on the right. And Cryospark, you can actually look at the source, but because of the license and so on, it's hard to actually make changes and do a print statement. Although Marcus has told me you can always get a developer's license and then you can change it. But so it's kind of in the middle, but Cryospark built quite heavily on RelyOn, on our target function, but I think you also had a very close look at our GPU implementation, right? Now there is new software, okay? Well, iMagic has been around for a while, of course. It's an example of closed source. And then I guess EPU is not, that's all commercial, so that's where we're hoping. But also, I don't know, new software packages have come out in the past year or two. Have a tendency to be more on the right-hand side than on the left-hand side. So MotionCore 2 is closed. GCDF hasn't been opened up. So that just, for me, raises the question. GCDF itself, but built on CTF-Fine. So who will build on closed software in the future? So this goes together with, we had a discussion, John and I, yesterday, but should we sponsor pharmaceutical big rich companies with our free developments, or should we have them pay for it? So there is many sides to this discussion, but having closed source is difficult for sharing and building on as an academic community. That brings me to my conclusions, which haven't changed. Image processing will continue to drive this field forward. Who said at the Gordon conference it will probably become a bit less sexy? As just happened, new hardware will continue to have impacts as well. There's new detectors coming on. Faceplates are still being developed. There's all kind of exciting things going on, new microscopes, etc. And making good samples already was crucial and will be ever more important. That was true in 2014, and that has even become more true now, I think. So just a little advertisement. I'm looking for a postdoc together with Michelle. If you want to study amyloids, please contact me. And then in 2014, we had an LMB course for which we edited the videos and put them online. We repeated that also in 2017. So we were on a similar time schedule as the NRAM workshop. So we just released all the videos again. So the URL hasn't changed, and you can now download all the videos of this year. And when we have new students come or postdocs coming in the lab who come from outside, we say, have a look at this first, and then we'll have a long chat. Okay, I think we're almost time for coffee. Thank you.
We've got time for questions.
Yeah, I think we have 8 minutes. Yeah. Very nice. So, anybody got questions?
Hi. So you mentioned overfitting and when we need to worry about overfitting. And so your, I believe, Reliant works with a L2 prior, sort of prevents spikiness in your data. And then CryoSpark also has, a sparse assigning L1 prior, so promotes sparsity. So these.
I think CryoSpark has L2 as well, right?
The original version.
Oh, sorry. But that doesn't get to the point of how can we diagnose if we are overfitting? Because we don't have like an R3, R-work kind of metric as the crystallography community does.
Right.
And have you guys thought about that?
Well, so keeping two half sets separate in refinement is a good way. Okay, so that's kind of, in practice, that works very well for refinement of homogeneous data sets. In multi-reference refinements where you don't know beforehand how the different classes spread over all the different models, that's much harder to implement. And there, in Reliant, we only rely on this L2 regularization, and then there's a fudge parameter. You can turn up the heat or turn it down. But there, it's still user kind of common sense and try to avoid buildup of high spatial frequency noise, but you have to be an expert in kind of seeing that. So overfitting and classification, I guess. Yeah, so phase randomization, Richard's high resolution noise substitution method, where you take the data and take the higher spatial frequencies and randomize the phases and then do exactly the same that you did before, can then, because then it should not have any signal beyond the frequency that you've randomized the phases. If it does come up, that would be a sign of overfitting as well. Yes, thank you, John.
Sure. On the subject of software for motion compensation, in the first few frames, as you pointed out, that's where the highest resolution is. There seem to be, to me, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like people either don't include those frames at all, they weight them zero, or they include them weight one and just let it contribute if it can. But I haven't heard anyone, has anyone explored doing a directional weighting? Because drift is mostly in one direction, so there should be almost perfect information in the other direction. Anybody taken advantage of that?
Well, we're currently thinking of doing exactly that. So if you can follow the motion for each particle in which direction it goes, then then perpendicular to that direction, the frequencies are still fine. So yes, we're looking at that. Most people throw away the first frames. That's if you use Motion Core 2 without any other things, it's probably a good idea to throw away frame 1 and perhaps even 2. I see people throw away 5 frames or so. That I would never do. But in Reliant, we try to keep all of them and then actually measure during the polishing step, where we make reconstructions from each frame individually and measure how the drop-off of signal is. And then we try and downweight the high spatial frequencies accordingly. So
downweighted everywhere or only in an azimuthally varying way?
Yes, so currently it's done in an isotropic everywhere, but you're completely right. Once you know from your motion tracking that the motion is horizontal, then the spatial Fourier components in the vertical direction are fine. Yeah. So yeah, we're looking into that now.
Okay. To expand on that, George, at one point Marcus and I worked out not just how to which Fourier components to preserve, but how to upweight the ones that had been downweighted by motion. If you know the trajectory of a particle and its direction and extent of motion within a frame, you can undo it.
Like deconvolution.
I thought there was an improvement. I mentioned it to Alexei, who it turns out had done exactly the same thing, showed me the mistake in my tests, and we both concluded there was absolutely no benefit from the methods we'd both derived identically but independently.
Okay.
And there probably are.
I mean, there is no reason why not to do it.
Right.
So I think we should just do it. And it might not help much in many cases, but yes. In some cases,
I mean, there were other ideas to explore, but they got quite complicated and probably warrant revisiting later.
So one of the things you didn't touch on was preferred orientation. And there's ways of getting around it with data collection. But I've always wondered, and maybe this is naive, that it seems like computationally we should be able to say normalize all the views so you get really isotropic resolution. But at the same time, maybe there's a balance. Maybe there's some amount of anisotropy that's fine as long as you have full Euler coverage. I was just wondering if you could sort of expand on that.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't touch on that. So the problem of preferred orientation is a lack of data in certain regions in Fourier space. Now, throwing away data in the regions that you do have is fundamentally not a real solution to account
but
for the lack.
If you have all the views, but they're just only 5%.
Yes.
Right?
So then, and I think Kai Zhang with some of the dynein structures in Andrew Carter's lab, they did that. They had preferred orientations, collected millions of particles, and threw away the majority, which was all in the preferred orientation, and then you got still something a bit more isotropic for the rest, and you could get it. So in some cases, it might work. It's not my preferred way of solving the problem, but usually, again, I when people have this problem, I tell them, well, either you go and collect a tilted data set, like the people here also have shown, and Chris has also shown, or you go and play again with your grid preparation and detergents and supports and so on, and see if that makes it better. Because it's a fundamental problem of lack of information, not surplus of information.
With regards to your multi-body finding a mask problem where you put it off to the user, could you not just use a rough model of normal modes of your current consensus structure to do it intelligently, potentially by software?
Yes, that's very true. I mean, currently it's just an implementation in Reliant. I mean, you could do all kind of clever things around it, yes. Good idea.